Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
We're launching a free new Aquinas 101 digital platform. Dive into the world of St. Thomas Aquinas with a customized learning environment, certificates of achievement, interactive elements, and a redesigned digital Summa Theologiae featuring a side-by-side Latin to English translation. To be notified when the platform goes live, sign up at go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. That's go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101.
It's a privilege for me to be here. I didn't know that this was the first Newman Center in America, and that's just the history here. You are also fortunate to be here, and I appreciate the invitation to come talk. I normally lecture from my computer, but had a crash, and I only have my old school lecture notes on John Henry Newman for this lecture, so I'm going way back in time. But this is one of my favorite texts of John Henry Newman's essay on doctrinal development. I want to teach you the seven notes. Have any of you read John Henry Newman's essay on doctrinal development? Okay, you're going to learn all about it tonight. My outline is to begin with some biography. I know some of you will already know all of this, but I'm going to talk a little bit about his biography, and then I'm going to give some intellectual background on why he writes this essay on doctrinal development, the context into which he writes it, and the sort of intellectual milieu into which he's writing philosophically around debates about skepticism and truth and evolution and the relationship between truth and change specifically. And then we will talk about the most famous aspect of his account of doctrinal development, his theory of doctrinal development, are these seven notes, or more properly, I think, he calls them his seven notes, but he also sometimes calls them his seven tests. And these are going to be seven tests for assessing what is true or false development. Can we assess whether or not things can change in a way which are faithful to the origins or which are a corruption or decay from the original idea or principle? So and we'll talk about all seven of these tests tonight. And the really fascinating thing that we're going to learn about these seven tests is that these seven tests for doctrinal development are what persuade John Henry Newman to become Catholic. And so these are not just a list of seven notes that are intellectually interesting, but they're a way of moving the mind towards the conversion of the heart to the truth of Catholicism. St. John Henry Cardinal Newman was born on February 21st in 1801 in London. He was the son of a pretty well-off banker. He was given an elite education. He became, in fact, very well-read in the thought of David Hume. Does anybody know David Hume, the great skeptic? And so by age 14, he was deep into skepticism, deep into the Enlightenment. So this is a precocious child. This is not the kid who's reading Harry Potter. He's reading David Hume. And then the next year, he becomes an evangelical. Now, weigh that in your mind, right? Skeptic, Humean skepticism, evangelical, okay? Does that sound like a radical conversion? Kind of, right? Not to him. In retrospect, he thinks these are actually two sides of the same coin. When he looks back on his transition from Humean skepticism to evangelicalism at 15 years of age, he reflects back to say that the evangelicalism was so imbued with religious affectivity and fideism, a kind of blind trust in the doctrine of justification by faith alone, that it was really just the flip side of his Humean skepticism. The Humean skepticism being a kind of subjectivism in which things always are only true as they seem to me on the basis of my experience. In this sense, Newman saw his very early turn from Humean skepticism to evangelicalism as two sides of what he calls the principle of Protestantism, which is the principle of private judgment, that I choose, I decide what is to be believed or not be believed. And then who is the standard for truth? Me. Here I stand. I can do no other, Luther says. In this sense, we're involved already in a kind of radical skepticism, a skepticism which emerges, of course, in the ancient world as well as in the modern world. I'll say a little bit more about that later. He studied at Oxford, and in 1825, he became an Anglican priest. And then soon after, or a few years after, with other Catholic-minded Anglicans, he began writing Tracts for the Times, which was an Anglo-Catholic movement, an attempt to kind of move away from the evangelicalism of his past towards a more Catholic understanding of being Anglican. This idea of being a Catholic-minded Anglican in the Oxford movement from 1828 to 1845 is built on something called the branch theory. And branch theory is, I was an Anglican once, so I can make fun of it. When I was an Anglican, we used to say, we're Catholic, but not through Rome. You ever heard that phrase? Well, we're Catholic, but not through Rome. That's branch theory. Branch theory is the idea that Christianity has these three branches. There's Anglican Catholicism, there's, you know, Eastern Catholicism, and then there's Roman Catholicism. These are three branches that flower off, and so we can be Catholic, but not through Rome. The view, of course, calling us Roman Catholics was already to kind of Protestantize Catholics. This Anglican branch theory bothers him on some level. By 1839, he comes to view Anglicanism as something less than Catholic, something not quite Catholic. How does he do that? He begins studying the Arian controversy. He begins studying stuff from the 4th century. The thing that he discovers when he studies the Arian controversy, the Arian crisis was massive. You had bishops who were Arians. It was a terrible, we think things are so bad in the church, we've got these bad bishops here and there. You have no idea how bad the Arian crisis was. People didn't know up from down. But when he looked at the Arian crisis, he saw that the Arians, or rather the semi-Arians, held the same view as the Anglicans. The Anglicans of the 19th century did not hold the same view in the Arian disputes as the Catholics did, but as the semi-Arians did. That created a crisis in Newman very early on, a crisis which propelled him to delve deep into history, to test this branch theory on which his Anglo-Catholicism rests. And it's from this period that we know the phrase, you probably have heard this phrase, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. Have you ever heard that phrase? That's a very classic Newman phrase, and it comes from this pre-Catholic period when he's beginning to see, oh my gosh, if I go back to the 4th century, and I, as an Anglican, I have to stand with the semi-Arians. I can't stand with the Catholics. And that is what it means to say to be deep in history, is to cease to be Protestant, because as he looked at that history, it doesn't look Catholic at all. His position doesn't. By the time he concludes writing his essay on the development of doctrine in 1845 at Littlemore, he also concludes that Catholicism is the living principle he had always been pursuing and was received into the church on October 9th, 1845 by Father Dominic Barbieri. So the essay can be read then as a kind of account of, shall we say, the dawning of an intellectual conversion. The dawning of an intellectual conversion. He does later in 1878 produce a new Catholic edition. The essay is kind of buttressed by a sort of new preface, and he wants to give it imprimatur. By the way, when he converted, he wanted the church to give an imprimatur to the essay on the doctrine of the development. The church said, no, don't do that. This, you didn't write this as a Catholic. Just put it out there. So he did, but later in 1878, when he produced a new edition, he was cardinal. And so he gave his own imprimatur as cardinal. Yep, I approve this. But the essay in the new edition is the same. And it stands as a testament to his confidence that the deposit of faith is a living thing. It's something which has vigor. We'll see the seventh note is about chronic vigor. Catholicism has vigor. It is true, and so it lives. Things which are true live and breathe and move. Before John Henry Newman was born, there was the question of doctrinal development. It exists in pockets. It's not a major question in church history for a variety of reasons, but there is one place in which, in the 5th century, St. Vincent of Lauran, in his Commonatorium, writes, "Let there be growth and abundant progress in understanding, knowledge, and wisdom in each and all, in individuals and in the whole church, at all times and in the progress of ages, but only with the proper limits, that is, within the same dogma, the same meaning, the same judgment," unquote. Do you hear that? So in the 5th century, Vincent of Lauran understands that an increase in understanding of Catholic truths is going to mean some external changes to things, some different ways of saying things over time, the progress of ages, but within proper limits, he says. And those limits are that it must be articulating the same dogma with the same meaning and the same judgment. Okay, you could say something about purgatory. You could say, okay, the Old Testament talks about praying for the dead, right? Augustine talks about an intermediate state. The medievals have a full-blown doctrine of purgatory. But the idea is the same, praying for the dead. The same dogma, the same meaning, the same judgment, but an elaboration and understanding of what that means. In 1870, in De Filiis, the First Vatican Council stresses this view of identity, that it must mean the same thing. And while many saw in Vatican II a greater stress on growth than identity, De Virbum stresses that growth is always and must always be growth in understanding what has been handed on. Growth in understanding what has been handed on, and not a departure from what has been handed on. Pope John XXIII opened the council, the Second Vatican Council, precisely with St. Vincent of Lauran to stress this point. The deposit of faith and the truths of that deposit are one thing, even as various ways of enunciating them unfold over time. To keep the same meaning and the same judgment, those are the watchwords that Newman learns from Vincent of Lauran. Newman discovers and elucidates, in a sense, precisely this Vincentian rule. So that's be one way to look at Newman, as in this line of Vincent of Lauran, this Vincentian rule. John Henry Newman seeks to articulate, then, how we could avoid, shall we say, dogmatic relativism, in which we say that dogmas can change over time and therefore they have no kind of inherent, unchangeable, eternal truth to them. And then on the other hand, to avoid a dogmatic absolutism in which you think that nothing can ever be learned about it that is new or seems new about the principle that the doctrine articulates. John Henry Newman wanted to avoid the kind of primitivist view which claimed the whole deposit of faith was clearly and completely understood from the beginning, and became less clear as it progressed through doctrinal accretions. That's basically the evangelical view. We just have to get back to the Bible. If we get back to the Bible, we'll be at the clear water, and we'll get rid of all these accretions of doctrine. And he wanted to avoid also this relativism. The Humean skepticism is bound up with this relativism, which leaves one skeptical about whether or not we can actually have any real contact with truth. Can we have real contact with truth? If we can have contact with truth, then there must be something that is eternally true. What that is, Newman usually calls a principle. That there's a principle in the doctrine which we must have contact with. And that when we have contact with that, what we're having contact with is the living deposit of faith. He charted a Vincentian middle way which maintained identity, same dogma, same meaning, same judgment, with the idea of growth in progress and understanding. Now, Newman's idea of development does actually bear some marks of modern 19th century, especially philosophical tendencies, not just in reaction to Hume, though he is in some sense reacting to Hume, but you also have Darwin's just about 6 or 7 years younger. So you have evolutionary materialism, going on. You have German Romanticism. Romanticism is especially important, though it's hard to see in Newman. The Romantics loved ideas about physical growth, about organic development. And you see that all over Newman. He's absolutely fascinated by organic development. How do things grow? Okay, well, that's a kind of modern way of thinking in that Romantics engage in. That for Newman, that's a way of actually trying to break back into the rules of nature. If you're thinking about how things grow, you're thinking about what's... He never uses metaphysical language because that's not in favor in the 19th century, but he's actually talking about metaphysics. He's actually saying, well, what, in Aristotelian terms, what is the essence of things and what's it ordered to? How is it going to develop? The 19th century thinkers almost always want to think about these questions not in metaphysical terms, but in terms of history, time, change, development, evolution. And so he's finding his way philosophically into a contemporary idiom, but he's leading them back to questions of substance. What's the nature? This analogy of physical growth, this analogy of an organic understanding of things, leads him not to materialism or skepticism or historicism, relativism, but to a powerful account of the miraculous unity of the Catholic faith. He uses, in a sense, the idiom, the philosophical idioms, against themselves, despoils the Egyptians, as it were. With that background in mind, we can turn to Newman's essay, I think, and understand it a little bit better. If you want to look it up on your phones or whatever, the fifth chapter of the essay is where you can almost follow along many of my remarks here. The fifth chapter of the essay is where he proposes this analogy of physical growth, that we should understand the doctrinal development on the analogy of like a tree growing, physical growth. And then he articulates seven notes for how would we articulate proper growth. If you look at a tree and say, well, what would be corrupt growth or decay or some problem with the tree, right? In which the tree wasn't being a tree. He, on analogy, looks at the questions of doctrinal development and says, okay, we have to have tests to decide how to distinguish between a true development and a false development, a faithful one or a corruption, a development or corruption. It's in these seven notes or tests that we see that development for Newman insists not on change, but development depends on what St. Vincent of Lauren said it did, identity. Semper idem. Anybody know Cardinal Ottaviani? Any Cardinal Ottaviani fans? He was like the super trad at Vatican II. He like led the trad rule. His episcopal motto was Semper Idem, always the same. The faith is always the same. It's never changed. But actually, that is Newman's view too. It's Newman's view of doctrinal development, is that the faith never changes. Articulations of the faith change. Okay, now to talk about these seven tests. Early on in the essay, Newman insists that the distinction between pure and corrupt development, because he can clearly see in the early church disputes about what constitutes a proper development of something prior. Right? How do we understand the Trinity, for example? Should we say that the Trinity is that the Holy Spirit is from the Father and the Son? The filioque clause, right? How do you determine that? What is the rule by which you can? What's the rule you point to? And he highlights the Disciplini Arcanum, a tradition that the sacred deposit was received completely and fully by the apostles and then mystagogically guarded. Have you read Plato? This is kind of how the Platonic Academy is understood. The Platonists are guarding the sacred truth. Well, that's the Disciplini Arcanum is like that, that the apostles, instead of the philosophers guarding the truth, the apostles are guarding this sacred deposit. And they're guarding it mystagogically, that is to say, they're guarding it with the Mass. They're guarding it liturgically. The deposit of faith was passed on but not publicly articulated. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, if the deposit of faith is passed on but not publicly articulated, that means that it's being handed on in a complete form. That the deposit of faith is complete. It's not growing in this way. It's not something that it
evolves, but that its growth is something which is a growth of understanding.
From this, Newman took the providentialist point that time is necessary for the understanding of the fullness of the deposit of faith, that we humans in our fallible human nature need time. We need time to understand what the sacred deposit is. Time is necessary to understand the fullness of the divine deposit. And so he writes, this may be called the theory of doctrinal development. It's the first time he talks about development. And notice what he calls it, a theory. It's going to be one of the payoffs, the conclusions of this talk, is that Newman's theory of doctrinal development is not a magisterial thing that you have to believe. It's a theory. It's a good theory. We're going to see just how good it is. This theory of doctrinal development is necessary for understanding the completeness and fullness of the sacred deposit. In the first chapter, Newman writes, the development means an increase in understanding an idea. The problem is not one of change, Newman writes, but the perfective standard for changes. By what standard do we judge the filioque clause to be a true development, right, of Trinitarian doctrine? This is where he says, to live is to change, to be perfect is to have changed often. So the real problem is not change per se. Now, that's a huge thing in the 19th century, right? But to say that the real problem is not change per se, but corruption. A false or unfaithful development is not an increase in understanding, but a kind of failure to understand. We see this in the church today where you get, oh, I won't mention any names, but famous priests who clearly want to change the church's teaching. What they are doing actually is demonstrating that they don't understand the church's teaching very, very consistently, a failure to understand. So the crucial question is, how can we know or test the difference between a true development and a corrupt development, which is not a development, of just a corruption? Newman gives seven tests, or as he calls them, notes, summarily outlined in chapter 5. The fifth chapter begins with his desire to draw out a positive argument for proving the intimate connection, or rather oneness, with primitive apostolic teaching, the deposit of faith. As he looks backwards from the 18th century to the 17th century to the 16th century, all the way back to the 5th and 3rd and 1st centuries, Newman sees the continuation of one religious system, like one organic, unified thing. He is in awe of the unity of Christian faith, in awe of the unity of Catholic faith in particular. He raises the question, he's a Protestant, right? He's Anglo-Catholic. And he raises the question, the only question that can be raised is whether the said Catholic faith, as now held, is logically, as well as historically, the representative of the ancient faith. In this sense, it's the same question about who would you be in the 4th century Arian crisis? Would you be the Catholic, or would you be the Arian or the semi-Arian? Who would you be? Newman maintains that it is that modern Catholicism, and here he's thinking of Vatican I as modern Catholicism, not like Jim Martin or something, that modern Catholicism is nothing else but simply the legitimate growth and complement, the natural and necessary development of the doctrine of the early church. In other words, the church's teachings in the 19th century are in perfect continuity with the first century. Perfect continuity, and you can demonstrate the legitimate growth all the way through it. He concludes that this is, in fact, what gives divine authority. It itself tests the divine authority, that no human being could construct that kind of unity, that unity is itself a test or an evidence of its divine authorship, that God made it. That places us not in some sort of Hegelian dialectic, but squarely on the notion of legitimate natural growth of the same substance towards the same end. Having become convinced of this, he pushes on this analogy of physical growth and how it would help us think about fidelity and corruption. Corruption, what does it do in organic life? Well, it disrupts something. It breaks it up, right? It introduces decay. It disintegrates the parts. Like when you see a body dying, you see the disintegration of the thing because well, in a human being, you see that the soul departs. That's what gives unity to the organic matter. And then you see the collapse of the parts into matter.
Corruption breaks things. It disintegrates parts that are organized. It leads to decay, death, corruption. It reverses and undoes things rather than integrates and creates things. So as we understand that corruption is losing touch with the laws of the thing. That's what corruption does. It loses touch. It loses memory, contact with laws, with distinctive traits, with vigor, with powers of assimilation, and principles of self-repair. That's a very important thing for Newman. Like, you know, a plant can fix itself. A body can heal itself. This is something that's fitting to a living thing. And this is fitting to the vigor of true Christianity.
Taking this analogy, this organic analogy as its guide, Newman says that we can discriminate healthy developments then from an idea very easily. We can discriminate it from corruption and decay. He writes that all seven notes can be summed up in one single sentence. He's a well-trained rhetorician. He begins the essay with a sentence which can sum up the whole thing, and he ends his essay with a sentence that can summarize the whole thing. You should all do that in your essays if you write essays.
Here's his single sentence summarizing the whole thing. There is no corruption if it retains one and the same type, principles, and organization. If its beginnings anticipate its subsequent phases, and its later phenomena protect and subserve its earlier phases. These are all conservative principles, right? If it has a power of assimilation, it can absorb things, and revival, it can renew things, and a vigorous action from first to last, right? Then there's no corruption. If it can't do all those things, then there's corruption somewhere along the line. You've got to figure out where that is. Now, that sentence includes all the notes in pairs. So, talk about the notes. The first note is preservation of type. Preservation of type is pretty much the Vincentian rule, identity, right? That we have his favorite example is, again, organic, that young birds don't become fishes. Birds do not grow into fishes. Children do not grow into beasts. Acorns do not become dragonflies. Frogs do not become princes, except in fairy tales, right? This is not something that happens. The preservation of type is that the doctrine will always follow the same law that natural bodies follow. Type will be preserved. A nature develops in accord with its essence, with its proportion, while remaining identically what it is. It gives this example of when you're in the womb, you have this tiny arm in the womb, a little tiny arm in the womb. And as a youth, you still have that same arm. The arm that you had in the womb, that little tiny, tiny arm that you had that showed up on the scan, it's the same arm that you have right now. And as you grow and you learn things, you begin to use that arm in different ways. And some people can use it in one way and other people can use it another way. You can use it for good and you can use it for bad. It develops. But it's always the same arm. It can grow exponentially. It can decay. It can have injury. But it's always the same type. He says this is what it is true for doctrine, too. Doctrines, to be counted as true development, one must be able to trace that it is remaining the same thing. He uses other analogies too. A unity of type doesn't have to be just natural analogies. It can be like a mayor or the nature of a town. Or it has to keep the preservation of type. Once the town becomes an empire, it's no longer a town, right? You've not preserved the type.
You can kind of multiply. You know, as soon as the Roman Republic becomes an empire, he says somewhat controversially,
it's not preserved the type of republic. The gospel is full of shocking surprises to the Jews, Newman writes. Yet everything contained in the old is revealed in the new. There is a continuity between law and gospel that is actually preserving the type. There's a preservation of type, even in that difference between law and gospel. Very, very different, right? You read the Old Testament, read the New Testament, they are externally different, but there's a preservation of type in the Bible.
between Jews and Christians. The church is outwardly very different than Israel, and yet it is inwardly the same, such that the fathers call the church the new Israel. It is a preservation of type. So that's the first note, that in order to understand a doctrine as having continuity and having true development, you have to demonstrate that it has preservation of type, moving from potency to act, if you want to use Aristotelian terms. I think it's implicit. Secondly, continuity of principles. This is a very important test for him. This becomes clear in the second note, where Newman says that the regulating power of doctrinal development is in the form or law or principle that the doctrines embody. This is the idea that the doctrine is kind of the articulation, and that the doctrine points you back to the implicit principle that was always there, that comes from the deposit of faith. So the principle is the kind of animating thing, and the doctrine is the articulation of the animating thing, if that makes sense. Doctrines are like, you might say, definitions of principles would be one way of putting it. Doctrines are like definitions of principles. And you could have the definition be changed and modified in various ways so long as it was demonstrating continuity of the principle. The definitions may develop, but they do not change the principles. The principles are the generative seed of doctrines. And so that, what's the test? The test is to see the principles through the doctrinal development, right? I give the example of praying for the dead, an intermediate state, purgatory. Can you trace, okay, those are different articulations, different definitions, but you can trace the same principle all the way through. Continuity of principles. To preserve its type, the church must preserve her principles, he writes. Thirdly, the power of assimilation. Catholicism is incredible at this. Catholicism is an assimilating machine. It can assimilate any culture. It can despoil the Egyptian. The church has this power of absorption or assimilation, or put differently, it has the power to incorporate without ceasing to be what she is. Very, very important. Without ceasing to be what she is. The church can assimilate without ceasing. If she ceases to be what she is, then we call that decay, corruption. But test for true Christianity, for true development, is this power of assimilation. And Anglicans don't have it. That's what he's learning. The church's assimilative power is also then like a proof for the divine nature of the church's teaching. Since the power of assimilation is really something only God could do at that kind of level of universality. The church absorbs the world in a way that doesn't preserve type and doesn't assimilate, then that has to be a corruption. Right? If the church is if people in the church are asking for it to change to become more like the world, right? That's decay, actually. What they're advocating for is decay. They're not actually advocating for something which is truly has the power of assimilation. Okay. Fourthly, logical sequence. The fourth test is logical sequence. This is something that can only be known a posteriori, that is, in retrospect. He's kind of secret Thomist or secret Aristotelian. Newman is. When we look back at the development of idea, we'll just stay with purgatory, development from praying for the dead to intermediate state, to doctrines, the doctrine of purgatory. What we can see in retrospect is those are logical developments. We could not foresee that praying for the dead would lead to a doctrine of intermediate state or then to a doctrine of purgatory. But in retrospect, we can say, oh, that's logical. That's a logical development. If you have a logical development, you can demonstrate it, that's a good test. Then you know you've got good. But if you don't have that, you said, well, hey, A doesn't lead to F, then there's something wrong. This, of course, fits another way of putting it, is that an illogical account of that development is a proof of decay. Ephesus's commitment, the Council of Ephesus' commitment to calling Mary Theotokos, God-bearer, right? Right, the opposition was wanting Christotokos because the Nestorians didn't want to offend God's transcendence. But Theotokos was a development. Ephesus' commitment to development fits with this account of logical sequence, because what you're claiming here is that Jesus is God, right? And that has already been
claimed, and so you have a principle of continuity, and it has logical sequence, and you know that is a true development. To start talking about Mary as Theotokos, developments of the Immaculate Conception, very, very similar. Her assumption into heaven, right, which was believed for a long time before it was declared a dogma of the faith. All of this is a posterior, looking back on retrogressively and saying, can you see logic in the step-by-step development over time? If you can, true development. If you can't, corruption. If the developments don't have a logical sequence and coherence to them, then you know you've got corruption. You've got to figure it out as a theologian or test the ecumenical problem. He specifically has ecumenical problems in mind. You call these corruptions Luther. Luther's doctrine of justification by faith alone, that doesn't have precedent. Right? There's no logical sequence to that. Therefore, it must be a corruption. If the developments lead you to some departure, like private judgment, Newman thinks of the Protestant principle as a principle of choosing for yourself. Right? That's the very definition of heresy, departure. So you don't have a logical sequence there in the development. The point is that doctrinal development cannot be prospective, that the test here is that we always look back. When liberals are actually plotting, in Ross Douthat's words, to change the church, Newman just says, well, if someone's trying to change the church, that is by definition not development. It is corruption. The desire to change the church is the commitment to corrupt. Whenever you hear that activist battle cry, we must change the church on X, Y, or Z to meet this need or that need, that's a call for corruption. That is not a call for development, regardless of the use of the language of development. Newman thinks development cannot be anticipated or planned for in advance, and so if you're trying to be an activist who is planning for it, you're already not doing development. Development is something that's only seen in retrospect. You cannot plan for it prospectively. And so logical sequence is something that is determined over a long run of time and is never something that someone produces. We had that after the Second Vatican Council. We had all these theologians who wanted to say that we should use contraception and that we needed to develop the church's teachings, develop the doctrine, already at odds with Newman. So the note here, the fourth note of logical sequence, is that a doctrine professed in its mature years is likely to be a true development, not a corruption, in proportion as it seems to be the logical issue of its original teaching. That is, if it seems in continuity with the logic of the original teaching of which it is considered a development. Okay, fifth, we've only got, three more? I can't do my math after that. The fifth note is anticipation of its future. This is kind of the flip side of only doing things in retrospect, is there's something about doctrine that will sometimes tell you about its future. It's a note that sounds prospective, but it's interesting. This is actually another retrospective point, and let me explain. I'll give a personal example of this. This is not a perfect example, but when I was a kid, my grandmother called me the professor. Now, it was a joke because I was occasionally precocious. I wasn't very often precocious. I had some precocious moments, and so I was nicknamed by my grandmother the professor, which seems like a prophecy, right? And it is a kind of anticipation of the future, but not one she intended. You see? Not one she intended. She didn't intend for me to become a professor. She had no knowledge of this world. But in anticipation of the future, you look back at it and say, oh, that has a kind of, there's an anticipation of the future here that they did not foresee, right? My grandmother did not foresee it. John Henry Newman's example is much better than mine. He cites the Third Academy skeptics, like Carneades, who claimed that they were continuous with Socrates, so that the great realists of the First Academy descend into the skepticism of the Second and Third Academy, and Carneades likes to claim the mantle of Socrates. And Newman says he does so on tenuous grounds that he used irony against other skeptics. But this fails the test because Socrates is a realist. He doesn't think that truths are just probabilities. It seems to me that. But that truth can really be known and that irony is a tool of rhetoric for the realist Socrates and has nothing in common with Carneadian skepticism. So it fails the test because we do not see in Socrates a sufficient anticipation of skepticism for Carneades to claim. See? So we know that's a corrupt claim, a false claim, an illogical claim. Doesn't have a proper anticipation of the future. He says if Carneades could have shown that he had deliberate doubts about it, that Socrates had deliberate doubts about first principles concerning God and morality, then he could have claimed there's an anticipation of the Carneadean position. If Paul of Samosata, a great heretic, can have errors which anticipate Nestorianism, or Berengar can state errors about the Eucharist that anticipate the errors of Zwingli, you have a kind of anticipation of the future. In those cases, they're anticipations of the future on the corrupt line. So you can also trace this on the corrupt line, or you can trace it on the true line. Augustine can state something about the intermediate state, which anticipates the medieval doctrine of purgatory. And that we see is a true anticipation of its future. So the fifth note is that a definite anticipation at an early period in the history of the idea to which it belongs is evidence of faithful development. Sixth note, conservative action upon its past. This is a kind of rule of fulfillment in a different direction. Regarding the law, Jesus said that he had come not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. That's a good rule for understanding this sixth note, that true development is always going to conserve the past. What you think about death penalty stuff, but it's, or the mass, debates about the mass, that you can, you know, that any kind of true development, a test of true development is that it's not ditching something that came prior, but adding on in such a way as to demonstrate a greater fulfillment of the thing. Jesus came not to destroy, but to fulfill. And so this principle of development is necessary. The idea that true development conserves everything from the past. You sometimes will hear that Catholicism always adds and never subtracts. This is the same principle. That the faith, we're always adding new understanding, new iterations of things, but we don't subtract. We never lose what we had always had, but we gain what it had not. True development, then, is always positive for Newman. Councils are a really good example of this, or papal encyclicals, right? I cite my predecessor at great length, right? That's this principle of a conservative action on the past. In order for me to say this, I must repeat everything that's been said before. Since my students sometimes get tired of reading Catholic documents because they're always doing that, right? They're always saying, as so-and-so said, and so-and-so said, and so-and-so said, I say with my predecessor that. That's this principle. That true development actually cares about that. It cares about that test because true development, it shows that church teaching is conserving its past. It's always a conservative action upon the past. There's some people who view that every council like supersedes the last one or something, like Vatican II is the council to rule all the councils or something. That's actually not the Catholic view. The Catholic view is that in some sense, it's true because every council carries up all the previous teaching, but it doesn't negate the previous teaching. It would be absurd to think that Vatican II negates Vatican I, for example, or that Vatican II supersedes Trent or negates Nicaea or Chalcedon, right? You just wouldn't say that. That's not how you think about it. You think about the councils building up not a hermeneutic of rupture, to borrow from Pope Benedict, but a hermeneutic of continuity, which conserves. This is necessary for true development. True development, Newman writes, conserves antecedent developments and adds to them, bringing out treasures old and new. This note ensures that all additions illustrate the past rather than obscure the past, corroborates the past rather than corrects the past, which precedes it. Developments which fail to do this are not developments, they're corruptions. Developments must demonstrate the unity of the Catholic creed. It must demonstrate what the heretics cannot demonstrate. The heretics are always dividing themselves, and the church, in its wisdom, must demonstrate the unity. Which is to say that true development bears the mark of Catholicity. It bears one of the marks of the church. the unity of truths across time. Newman writes, a developed doctrine which reverses the course of development which has preceded it is no true development but a corruption. If the doctrine of Christ's hypostatic union were itself developed so as to say that the two natures were indistinguishable in their personal union, that would in fact be a corruption, or indeed a heresy. But the note here is simple. The sixth test is the tendency to conserve what's gone before. Finally, the seventh test. I know we've been waiting for it. Chronic vigor. Romantic again. This is romantic. Chronic vigor. But it's true. Or we might say perseverance. As he puts it, the course of heresies is always short compared to true development. Always short. It feels long to us because we live with it, right? The Arian crisis felt long to people living in the Arian crisis. It's like 70 years or something. Can you imagine if you were like 20 years into the Arian crisis and you were going to die in the Arian crisis? I feel that way sometimes in the church. but it's really short, actually. The crisis is short compared to true development. Newman says, corruption always leads to decline. Corruption in the church, you're going to lose vocations, you're going to lose people from the pews, you're going to lose all sorts of things, you're going to get decline. Decline, whereas true development always leads to vigor, to life-giving energy. Arianism, Nestorianism, Monophysitist communions were certainly kept together for a time, but they lacked the chronic vigor and died out. Can be reinvigorated under different. We had certain Manichaean Gnosticism, which was reinvigorated as Albigensianism later, right? So you get the heresies coming back, but they don't come back, but they don't have chronic vigor. They don't have perseverance. They die out and then they come back in mutated forms. True development doesn't do that. It has a living unity, which is constant, which perseveres, which has vigor, which has fortitude, tenacity. He likes that word, tenacity. It's got stickiness, staying power, which exceeds historical circumstances. Okay, so to summarize, Newman's seven notes are really about what? What they're really about is truth. They're really about truth. They're absolutely about the unchanging nature of truth, right? These are tests for truth in an age of skepticism. And that's what we live into. We live in an age of skepticism, not Humean skepticism per se, but we live in a time in which people are starving for truth. And here's tests for what is the standard. What's the perfective standard for our understanding of what's eternally true? And these seven notes give him this. And interestingly, they give him these tools for understanding development, understanding change, understanding what a Hegelian would call dialectic or evolution in terms which lead him not away from the faith, but to it. So is there something radical here about Newman turning questions about truth and change into an apologetic for the Catholic faith before he's a Catholic? It's so actually extraordinary to think about Newman a little bit like if you've read the other text I talk about a lot is Augustine's Confessions. In Augustine's Confessions, he has his intellectual conversion before he has his conversion of will, before he actually becomes a Catholic. And we see that right here in the essay. Is Newman is intellectually seeing, actually, this is what Catholicism is. It has this. It has preservation of type, it has continuity of principles, it has the power of assimilation over time, it has logical sequence, it has an anticipation of its future, it is always a conservative action on the past, and it has chronic vigor, and therefore it is the only living form of Christianity. It is the living form of the deposit of faith, which was handed on once and delivered once for all, and handed on and guarded by the apostles. He says, in this sense, I think the seven notes are a kind of proof for the truth of Catholicism. He says the seven notes can be counted as one and the same. So you got seven notes, and he says, but they're just really one thing. They guarantee the substantial unity of truth. One in type, system of principles. One in unit of power through towards externals. One in logical consecutiveness. One in witness to early to later, one in protection of later to earlier, one in union of vigor, continuance, and tenacity. And in this sense, John Henry Newman thought, you could see that the deposit of faith has always been the same, semper idem. And this was evidence that it is true and divine.
Now, again, I want to stress here at the end, my last kind of coda, and then we can have questions. I don't know if we have time for questions, but I really want to stress, he called this a theory. This is a theory. Newman's essay on doctrinal development is a theory about how to understand the way in which things seem to develop but stay the same. Cardinal Ottaviani, semper idem. Ottaviani never accepted the theory of doctrinal development. He was always respectful to Newman, but he never accepted it. This is a theologian's theory. Right? The church has no need of that theory. And in a sense, Cardinal Ottaviani has a point. And the American theologian, actually my predecessor from the 1950s, Joseph Cardinal Fenton, had the same view. The theory of doctrinal development was not necessary to the church. Theologians were free to think it, but it's not necessary to the church. The church doesn't need a theory of doctrinal development. It just has the sacred deposit. I think there's actually something to that. Without taking anything away from it, I think actually Ottaviani and Fenton have a point. We needn't regard the theory as something magisterial, but the theory is kind of like the catechism. It reflects back on the teaching in such a way as to help you understand it, help you understand its coherence, its vigor, its continuity, its unity, its universality, its catholicity. So we needn't regard it as magisterial to learn from it. But I think, in a sense, Newman gives us a way of understanding how understanding the meme. Do you know the meme, where you go through all the Protestant sects and when they were founded, you know, what, you know, you're Methodist and you were founded in, you know, 1746 by John Wesley, and you go down, you're Lutheran, or you were founded, right, in, you know, 1515 or whatever, 1525 by Luther, and when was Catholicism founded? Well, it was founded by Jesus Christ. And that, in a sense, is it, that the church was founded by God. The church was founded by Jesus Christ, and it's the church's teachings is therefore something which is always staying the same. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.